The role of the church in God's plan is a series that I'm doing in my other church. And to understand the role of the church in God's plan, it is very important that we understand the role of Israel in God's plan to begin with. Unless we have a clear understanding of what God wanted Israel to achieve, to accomplish, then we completely miss about the role of the church, our church, ultimately, in God's plan. Now, the moment that God has to get the help of people to turn his plan into reality, God meets a problem. That problem is human will, because the human will and God's will are not always in sync, as we know. In your own lives, God's will for you doesn't necessarily meet your will for yourself. And God gave human beings freedom so that at times they may decide that they don't want to go along with God's will. And that, to some extent, to a large extent actually, is a hurdle in God's fulfillment, in the fulfillment of God's plan. In theology, and I think I've shared that with you a while back, I will just run over it one more time. In theology, we call this God's ideal will and God's circumstantial will. God's ideal will is what he has planned to do. God's circumstantial will is what he ends up doing because he has to take into consideration our own freedom. Example, God's ideal will was that the people of Israel would walk from Egypt into Canaan in a matter of months. But when they came to the gates of Canaan, they got scared, and so God's circumstantial will was that they had to spend another 38 years. Now, God had never planned that. Now, when I say God had never planned that, I don't mean that he didn't knew that it would happen. He didn't know that it would happen. He knew, because God can, to some extent or to a large extent, depending on the school of theology you adhere to, know the future. But God's circumstantial will was done, and at the end of 40 years, they walked into Canaan. But that wasn't God's ideal will. God's ideal will was that man and woman, that the human race would enjoy eternal happiness. God's circumstantial will is the plan of salvation. Had Adam and Eve not sinned, there would have been no need for a plan of salvation. Correct or not? True or false? So the plan of salvation is God's circumstantial will that he had to put into motion because of the free choice of Adam and Eve. And so when we talk of the role of Israel and later the role of the church, we need always to remember that Israel and later the church did not always give permission to God to accomplish his ideal will, and God takes into consideration the freedom that he's given to individuals, to people, to human beings, and so God has to adapt. Now, when I said that once in a church, they said, well, there's a verse that says that God never changes. And maybe that verse came to your mind right now. Well, that's true and not true. God doesn't change in terms of his character. He changes all the time in terms of adapting to human situation. The cross is God's adapting to sin, isn't it? He had to have the cross as part of his plan. So having said that, right from the beginning, we see a number of times where God failed. And again, I'm saying that with this background. Where God's plan failed because the human race, the human beings that he was counting on to help him achieve the plan, didn't cooperate. It started in Eden. Then, right after Eden, we have what the Bible calls the Son of God and the Son of Man. God wanted to use the Son of God to bring the human race back to him, but the Son of God saw that the daughters of the Son of Man were pretty and cute, and they turned away from God's plan for the sake of the love of the daughters of the Son of Man. And the result of that is chapter 6 of Genesis, where it says that a time came when all the thoughts of men were essentially evil. That's right. Now, that's what happens when people don't cooperate. So then the flood happens. The flood is God's circumstantial will. And in fact, I wish I had, well, maybe one day we'll do that. If you study the story of the flood, you'll see that the flood is a direct reversal of creation. Some of you may have noticed that. You know, creation starts with God separating the waters from the ground, and then you have the firmament or the atmosphere and the dry ground. And if you read the story of the flood, then God causes water from above to join with the waters gushing from below, and then the whole world is destroyed and turned back into the abysmal situation that was there before creation. And I could show you that everything God did over those 7 days somehow gets disrupted by the flood story. So sin gets God to undo the perfect thing he's done before. And that's one thing we need to remember when we're tempted. Any sin we do gets God to undo some of the things that he did. You know, sometimes we look at sin just as the bad thing I've done to myself or to somebody else, but it's cosmic in its dimension. Every sin is cosmic in its dimension. So God, the plan fails. Then God chooses Noah, and then Noah also isn't all that righteous a guy, you know. After Noah, God gives an order. He says, scatter all over the world and fill the world. And there's this guy by the name, this man by the name of Nimrod. And in the Bible, it says Nimrod was a great hunter in front of the Lord. If you go to the original, the word can be translated two different ways, either a great hunter or a great warrior. And the word that follows that we have translated by before, he was a great warrior before the Lord, that same Hebrew word can also be translated against. And as you look at the story, it would seem that against should be a better translation. Nimrod, against God's will to fill the world, decided, let's build a tower and let's all live together. And so God has to come and undo it again. Circumstantial plan. So that's another failure, the fourth in a series of failures of God's plan. And then we come to Abraham. And you know, Abraham is a great fella, but he's not all that great a fellow. It took him years before he understood what was God's plan. And he couldn't wait, so he starts something on his own, and the result is Hagar's son Ishmael, which has been a thorn in the spreading of the gospel to this day. You know, then again, man's will, God respects it. You know, that's one prayer that should have never been prayed. When Abraham said, may my son Ishmael live before you, God says, okay, he will. And we know what happened later in history, and I don't want to go into that today. So God still has a plan, and the plan is, we read it in Genesis chapter 12, it's a verse that you know, when God says to Abraham, all the people of the earth shall be blessed in your seed. You know the text, Genesis 1 verse 2 and 3. In your seed has two meanings. It means, firstly, it means the immediate seed, which is the people of Israel. And secondly, it means the forthcoming seed, which is Jesus Christ. So God's plan to save, to recuperate the world from sin, from the sinful condition it found itself in since that first day in Eden, was to use people to reach out to people. But again, like I've just said, when God uses people to reach out to people, he has to introduce in his planning people's cooperation, sometimes positive, sometimes negative. And that's the way it is. It's important to remember this concept. So, the seed of Abraham, the immediate seed of Abraham, was Isaac, Jacob, then the 12, then the people of Israel. And God's intent was to use the people of Israel as a showcase for the rest of the world. He didn't intend to use Israel to preach. He intended to use Israel to show what he can do when people cooperate with him. So for God to do that, he will allow Israel to go into captivity for 400 years. There are two reasons why God does that. One reason is Israel had to come to a point where they understood that they could not rely on themselves for anything. You know, at first in Egypt, they were well considered. They were given the best of land, Goshen, fertile place in Egypt. But eventually, a new dynasty arose that did not know God, did not know Joseph, and they started to turn Israel into slaves. And that was going to go on for 400 years approximately, a little bit less, a little bit more, whatever. There's another reason why God gave that space of time, because it says in Genesis chapter 15, The sinfulness of the Canaanites hasn't yet reached its utmost. So there is a question of God's patience for the people of Canaan. Now, you may ask yourself, how would the people of Canaan know about God? Well, they would know about God because of Abraham. How? When you read the story of Abraham, it says that Abraham, for a number of years, walked up and down Canaan, and wherever he stopped, what did he do? He built an altar to the Lord. Now, you must remember that Abraham did not own any land in Canaan. That had not been given to him yet. It was going to be given to his great-great-great-great-grandchildren, Israel, but not to him. He didn't even have land to bury his wife. He had to buy a cave from a Hittite. So wherever Abraham built his altar, he had to have the permission of the clan on whose land he was, which means that he had to explain to them about God. So the name of God was known throughout Canaan through the ministry of Abraham, and God gave them 400 years to respond to that knowledge. At the end of 400 years, they still said no to God, and we'll explain in a minute how they did that. So two things were happening: the maturing of sinfulness in Canaan and the lowering of self-confidence of Israel in Egypt. And as their self-confidence lowered to the point where they cried unto the Lord for help, they understood that without God they could do nothing. And that's when they were ready to accept God's intervention in their favor. So God talks to Moses in the burning bush. And I think I had a sermon here on the burning bush a while back. And I told you that the burning bush, when God says, take off your shoes, it was not just a question of shoes are sinful or these are things that shouldn't be in God's presence. It was more about God saying to Moses, where I am is a safe place. Remember I told you that you don't walk barefoot in a desert, not in that desert. There are biting insects, stinging animals, sharp stones, and long thorns from all those thorn bushes that grows in that part of Sinai. In fact, they are called Egyptian bushes, long 10-centimeter long thorns. And nobody walks barefoot. And then God says to Moses, take off your shoes. Come on, God. This is not safe ground to walk shoeless. But what God was saying is, don't be scared. Where I am is security. There's safety where I am. There's holiness as well. So these things go always together. So God speaks to Moses and says, I want you to go and free my people, which is a pure act of grace. The people did not deserve it. They did not qualify for it. The only thing they did was they cry unto the Lord. And when people cry unto God, God acts. Because he's a God of love, a God of compassion. You know, Jesus spoke about the same thing much later when he came. And he gave a parable about that. It's called the parable of the Good Samaritan. And somebody said, who's my neighbor? And Jesus answered, whoever is in need. And that's what your song is about. You know, we close the door, we don't hear what's going on out there, but we forget that the crowd out there, God cares for them. We sing all those nice hymns, but we forget, again, that God is out there probably more than in here. Well, possibly more than in here. You know? So, pure grace. Pure grace, God comes and God secures the freedom of Israel. Israel has to do nothing for it. Erroneously, some people believe that the condition was the Passover sacrifice. Passover was never a condition set by God. It was an act of appreciation for what God did, to show that they agreed and they were willing to go along with God's plan. They were willing to see things through God's eyes. It was not, if you don't do it, you won't be saved. It's more, you understand what I want to do, why don't you plug in? Why don't you go along with it? And in theology, we don't use the Passover as a sign of a sacrifice that shows a condition for salvation. If we've done that, that was erroneous, that was wrong. Anyway, so then God takes the people out of Israel. Remember, we're talking about Israel's role in God's plan. Now, God has saved the people unconditionally. And he takes them to Sinai. Now, what's the purpose of Sinai in God's plan? God now has a saved people. But that people is not a showcase yet. Now he needs a transformed people. Salvation is always free. Transformation requires our participation. And that's where God's plan can go awry if people refuse to participate. So, God's salvation was freely given to Israel, and not just to Israel, to just anyone who wanted to walk out. And the Bible says that a huge crowd of foreigners walked out. Probably all the other slaves in Egypt walked out. There were slaves from all the other countries that were there, because Egypt was this dominating power. And I'm pretty sure that that crowd of strangers was made up of those other slaves, and of Egyptians as well. In fact, God would have wanted to save the whole country. Did God love that country? How do we know? Go back a few hundred years. Joseph saved the country from what? And how did he do it? It was with God's grace. So God loved the Egyptians just as much. And had the king not hardened his heart, those things would have never happened to the Egyptians. Never. Anyway, so God has saved the people unconditionally. They are a saved people, and we find that in Exodus chapter 20, where God says, I am the God that has liberated you. You're free. That's what salvation is. Never, never, never please set any condition for salvation. There isn't. It's just a question of God answering to the crying out of the people. And now God is going to start the process of changing the people into the kind of showcase that he wants to show to the whole world. And how does God do that? He gives them what we, again, erroneously call the Ten Commandments, because if you read it in the original language, it's not written in the shape of a commandment. What it really says in the original language is very beautiful. Now, I've done very little of the original language, but I read a lot about it. What it says in Hebrew is, because I'm your God and I'm with you, this is how you're going to behave. What are we talking about here? Command or result? It's a result. If God is with me, I won't have any other God. If God is with me, I will not have to bow down to idols. If God is within me, I will respect his name. It's not, I am your God, now don't have any other gods. You know, we've translated it into a very commanding type of thing, an order, like in a military structure. That's not the idea. The idea is, because if we say, don't do that, it comes as if God is expecting me not to do it to please him, or so that he won't zap me. But if God says, I dwell in you, this is what you're going to be like now. That's a whole different thing. It's positive, isn't it? And we need to stop, well, that's the way we read it in the Bible, but we need to explain that to our children. God doesn't say, don't do it, otherwise I'll behead you or stone you. God says, no, if you accept me in your life, this is what will happen. And that's exactly what Jesus said again later. I am the tree, you are the branches, and if you dwell in me and I in you, you will what? Produce fruits. Jesus was just giving a comment on what happened on Mount Sinai. Then God says something else. Remember what we're talking about now. He's shaping Israel to become a showcase. God says, to show you that I am with you, build me a temple so that I may what? Dwell in your midst. Now, you've got to tie that to the story of the burning bush. Where God is, there are two things. There's holiness, there's safety. So God said, as I am going to change you gradually, don't be afraid, because where I am, there's safety. But also where I am, there's holiness. So I'm going to change you into a holy people, as long as we keep, well, I'm going to do that many times, as long as we keep what? Connected. As long as we keep connected. That was God's purpose. And this purpose was designed to change God's people individually and corporately. You know, we are saved. And I'm going to say something very important that we tend to believe. Salvation is never a one-person thing. We are saved individually. We are transformed corporately. I cannot be transformed in isolation. You want me to illustrate? How do I love patience unless God gives me a church where full of people who try my patience? Or a family who tries my patience? Or I try the patience of my wife or whoever? God cannot teach patience to anybody unless he places them in a situation where they learn patience. So if you have an idea that I'm staying home, I'm watching this religious program, I don't need to go to church, I don't need to connect, well, God cannot change you because God cannot do that in isolation. Impossible. Now you may say, Pastor, are there things impossible with God? Yes. Not impossible because he doesn't have the power, impossible because he knows that it's not wise to do it this way. God's wisdom always controls his power, all the time. So he knows what's best because of his wisdom. So church is important because that's where you learn to relate to people who've got eyes like this, who've got little kinky hair, who've got black skin or white skin or whatever it is. That's where you learn to deal with them. And when we have churches that separate along those lines, we are going against God's will to change people. It's as simple as that. Of course, the problem is much more complex. But I'm just simplifying here. So God changes people. I mean, God saves people individually. He changes people corporately all the time. All the time. And so God said, build me a temple for me to do these things and also for me to define what true religion is. True religion, based on this story that I'm telling you, is connection with God so that God's blessing can flow through whoever is connected to whoever needs the blessing. It's always this way. It's never that way. God's blessing comes down through me, through the church, for those people that we tend to leave outside because we close our doors. Okay? So that's what the temple stood for. And so God said, okay, now, if you live according to that, remember, this is not about being saved. They are already saved. But now it's about transformation to become a showcase. So God says, if you're going to accept this structure, then all kinds of blessings will happen to you. Cause and effect type of thing. And God says, and I'm going to list you very quickly a few of those blessings. He says, your field will produce. Your cattle will grow young, sturdy, healthy young ones. Your wives will never be barren. Your children will grow up like cedars in Lebanon. That's Psalms 92. Our children grew up like cedars in Lebanon. Social blessings. Blessings in the realm of agriculture and farming. Blessings in terms of how do you relate to one another. You know, societal structures. Blessings in the realm of health. God said, you will not suffer from all those diseases that the Egyptians suffered from. Archaeology has discovered a series of tablets. You know, that's the way people wrote back then, little clay tablets with scripture writings on them. And they are called, no, it's not a tablet, it's a papyrus, sorry, papyrus. And it's called the Heber, H-E-B-E-R, by the name of the discoverer, papyrus. And there's a very interesting little book that's been written based on that discovery. The Heber papyrus has to do with the medical practices of the day in Moses' time. The medicine that Egyptians and Babylonians and all those nations used. And it's very interesting when you read that. Translation has been made of that. And you compare it to what God teaches Israel in terms of medical, of health habits. It's incredible. For example, again, you know, these are things you may read so quickly that you never stop. God says when you travel, and you forgive me if you feel that it's a bit trite, well, it's in the Bible, so I can say it. He says, when you travel, always take a little shovel with you, so that when you need to relieve yourself, you'll go out of the camp, you'll dig a hole, and you'll cover it. What is that about? What word would we use today? Hygiene and sanitation. Now, people around them didn't do that. Wash your hands. Lots of things like this. Let me give you one example, just one taken from the Faber Papyrus. It's about if you have a wound, if you've been cut or, you know, a deep wound. And you know what was the remedy? Some of you might fancy trying it. Take horse's blood, congeal it, add to it the powder of dried cat's tongue. Take cat's tongue, put it to dry in the oven, then reduce it into a powder. Add the venom from a rattlesnake and mix the whole with cow dung, then apply it as a poultice. Now, you can understand why lots of those mummies that we find in the Egyptian museums, we know today that they died of one disease that happens when you get a wound. What's that disease? How do you say it in English? Tetanus. We know that people died of tetanus. Well, with that kind of health practices, of course they would, wouldn't they? Well, God says, no, if you're wounded, wash it, then go to the priest and check it out and that sort of thing. So God gives them these simple health notions that completely turns upside down the accumulated medical knowledge of the day. I have a little book at home. It's called You Won't Suffer from These Diseases, and it's about the Heber Papyrus. So you can see that as God provided all these things to Israel, and at the same time he was changing them in terms of relational, they becoming better and better and nicer people. I want you to get this picture. All right, let's take a picture from this country. There are some people that have come here in the last 20 years as poor migrants. And through hard work, today they own a few homes and a few stores and their kids have PhDs and all that. You know, this happens. It doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen, doesn't it? Right? And many Aussies look at some of those migrants and say, how come in 20 years now they are there? And they kind of resent it. Some of them resent it. Others say, well, it's the result of hard work. But we question it because people who had nothing to begin with suddenly are up there and we wonder, how did it happen? Right? Well, imagine a whole nation, slaves, had nothing going for them, absolutely nothing. And God places them in a place where they become the focal point of the whole world, which is why God placed them in Palestine, because back then Palestine was the center of the world. To go from the east to the west, from the north to the south, you had to cross Palestine. That's why he places them. So that as they would grow and develop into that showcase, the nations around would see what God was doing, and they would send ambassadors. How do I know that? Well, you read that in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 35. It says, the kings of the earth sent ambassadors to look at what was happening in Israel under Solomon's guidance, and they went back glorifying God. Not glorifying Solomon, glorifying God. Can you see the showcase working? And we have one example, a very interesting example, the queen of Sheba. She goes back glorifying God. And there is some historical evidence to suggest that Ethiopia, which is a country that kept the Sabbath until the 16th century, where did they get that? Possibly all the way back to the visit of Queen of Sheba to Israel, to Solomon. There's even a legend that the kings of Ethiopia were a child, came from one boy child that the queen had from Solomon. This one, I don't know that we can give credibility to that, but that's the way they talk about it in Ethiopia. So here's a nation, the Ethiopians, who learn about God through watching Israel. So this is what God's plan was, that Israel would become a model to the world to show what happens when God saves and when God changes people into his own likeness. You're getting an idea of what was Israel's role in God's plan? But remember, for that to work, the people have to submit their own will, their free will, to God's ideal will. And God cannot force anybody to do that. And he will not force anybody to do that. Never. Never. God's purpose, you read that in Isaiah 56, verse 1, so that my house shall become what? You should know these verses. A house of prayer for all the people. Last week in my sermon on patriotism, which I told you cannot find any support in the Bible, God, and I said to you, God never intended Israel to become a political entity. Because by definition, a political entity excludes. Unless you belong to the party, you're excluded. But God's plan was, my house of prayer, the center of who you are, is going to draw people. So God never gave Israel a national political identity. Never. And I developed the idea to you that patriotism is what separates people today, and the twain never meet. Not just in wars, but in politics, in finances, and on the cricket ground these days in South Africa over there. They never meet. Because we are defending the honor and prestige of our country. So you've got to lose. And we Christians need to give a serious thought about these things. Now, I'm not saying that I'm against Pope. But think where what is being used, how it's being used today. By the way, we sent our kids to a school and they played sports, but they had a very good way of doing it, and I praised them when I found out. You know, they would play a game of soccer, for example, 11 aside, you know soccer. And whenever a team scored, they would reshuffle the teams. So that at the end of the game, who had won? Everybody won. And I thought, well, that's a good way of enjoying a game and yet not going away feeling I'm better than you, I'm stronger than you, you know, which is contrary to God's idea about having his character. Anyway, this was God's plan for Israel. Now, let me end this morning's presentation by showing how it failed. Let's turn our Bibles. Now we're going to take a few texts to the book of Judges. Have you ever, after reading the book of Judges, it comes right after Joshua. First of all, who has read the book of Judges a number of times? Let me see. Not too many. Do you have Judges in your Bible? Well, the book of Judges, I've just told you, whenever I read it, at least a while back, when I was reading it, whenever I read it, I would say, what is this book doing in the Bible? It's full of violence, full of bloodshed, full of intrigue, full of all kinds of bad things. You can scarcely find a positive story in the book of Judges. You'll have some good, but most of it is evil. Now, let me give you the background. Moses dies. Joshua takes over. Now, Joshua was there all the way from the liberation from Egypt. He had witnessed it all. And Joshua takes over. They come and start to settle in the land. And now we turn to Judges chapter 2. Chapter 2, we read verse 10. In fact, verse 6. Let's read from verse 6. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his own inheritance. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done. You get that? Now go to verse 10. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers when they had died, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then they did evil in the eyes of God and they served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. What happens within three generations? What's happened? Come on, share, talk. Talk to me. They've lost sight of the plan of God ultimately. They've lost, and I want you to remember that because I believe strongly that our church today is through the same thing. We've lost sight of the vision of our pioneers. I'm not talking about the way they preach. I'm talking about the vision. But anyway, we'll come to that later. So they lost sight and they turned to the idols. So instead of becoming a showcase about what God can do. Now they start doing the same things that the pagans were doing. Can you see how God's plan is starting to go awry? Not because of him, but because of the people doing their own will. And so, this is the introduction to the book. And somebody, and listen carefully, somebody looking back at this period, now you may not know it, but the judges cover 480 years approximately. That's a long time period. A long period of time during which Israel constantly abandons God to do the things of the other nations around. Curtailing God's plan. And so at the end of the book, we come to this very laconic sentence, chapter 21. And before I read the verse to you, a little bit of background. There is this thinker. He is looking at the period of the judges. All those ugly stories. I was sharing that with the young people in my class downstairs because they had asked me a question. You know, down there we have a fun time because we relate to reality. In other words, questions that are bugging them. They want to know answers. So they said, Pastor, how do we understand all those gory, bloody things in stories in the Bible? The violence. And I shared with them, okay. First reason, the people forgot about God and they forgot about the role they were to play. And so this fellow, thinking about it, 480 years later, because the story he writes covers 480 years, he's a historian, a chronicler, and we read verse 25. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw, what? Fit. So that's his conclusion. The people are misbehaving because there is no authority. Now that's a wrong conclusion. The good conclusion is they did wrong because they gave up on God. But this guy, we don't know who he is. Nobody knows who's written this book. Looking back, he says, the people did all those horrible things because there was no king. Obviously, he was one in favor of kings. And then you have the story of Samuel, who's the last judge. Let's turn to Samuel chapter 8. Samuel chapter 8. Verse 1. Chapter 8, verse 1. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they served at Beersheba, but his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside. So now it's not just the people who are turning aside. Who's turning aside as well? The judges. And in that context, so all the elders gathered together came to Samuel and said, you are old, your sons do not walk in your ways, appoint a king to lead us. Now, that was legitimate because they're seeing the fall, the stumbling of Israel. So they say, appoint a judge, appoint a king. But then there's something that they add, so that we will be like all the other nations. That's the political side of it. And obviously, for these elders to have come to this conclusion, they certainly knew about the chronicles written about the 480 years of history by the author of the book of Judges. Because he had compiled all those terrible things. So, they decide to have a king. And this fellow and those elders believe that if the king is there, Israel will once again rise up to its calling. But it didn't happen. The first king was a failure. The second king was also a bit of a failure, David. You know, we today sing the praise of David, but he was quite a rascal. I think I mentioned to you one day that I certainly wouldn't like to have had David as a neighbor, especially if he had a house that had a floor higher than mine and could see into the bathroom. I mean, would you feel secure with a guy like this? Are you married? And he still feels like that. But that's David. Now, he did lots of stupid things. He did lots of good things too. The great thing about David is that he repented. And he accepted the responsibility. He never said, he is to blame or she is to blame. He accepted it. And that's why he was God's friend. But David failed to some extent. Then Solomon comes. And he starts his reign by praying this beautiful prayer where he says, I don't want money, I don't want wealth, I don't want power, I want your presence and your wisdom. And he starts beautifully, the Queen of Sheba. But then he forgets that security is where God is. In fact, he builds this magnificent temple which says, where God is, there's safety. But he doesn't believe it. How do I know? He marries a number of princesses. Now, this had nothing to do with lust. It had to do with political thing. I'll marry the daughter of Egyptian king so that he won't fight me. I'll marry the daughter of the Sidonian king so he won't attack me. And so he marries a number of foreign princesses to secure the political alliance with those nations. But in doing that, he also gives up on God. How do I know? Well, the story says that he built temples for each one of his wives. So Solomon, as a king, is also a failure. Now, this guy who said in those days they did everything because they had no king, had he lived to the point of to the time of Solomon, he would have said, well, kings aren't good either. And so we have another 1,000 years, well, not exactly 1,000 years, 700 years, 600 and some years of kings. And when you read the stories of the kings in the book 1 and 2 Kings, this is the background that you should have in your mind to understand. And those kings, except for one or two, all of them are failures. And turn to 2 Kings 25, please. No, 21, as we bring this to a close. 2 Kings 21. Background, there's this king called Hezekiah. One day Hezekiah falls sick and he's going to die. But nobody likes to die. And so he calls in the prophet Isaiah. And he says, Isaiah, please pray to God that he spares my life. That's another of those prayers that should never have been prayed. But anyway, God spares his life. How many more years? 15 more years. Now, why am I drawing your attention to 15 years? Because 3 years later, into his healing, he fathers a son, Manasseh. Now, let's read about Manasseh. 21. Manasseh was 12 years old, you see, 3 years after his healing, when he became king. And he reigned 55 years, the longest reigning king. 55 years. His mother's name was Hephzibah. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, following the detestable practices of the nations that God had driven out. He rebuilt the high places, that's idolous worship, idolatry. Then what does he do? The places that his father had destroyed, he erected altars to Baal and to Ashtaroth, as Ahab had done. He bowed down to all the starry hosts. Who did he worship? Stars. Do you happen to read astrology sometimes? Anyway, I'm just saying that in passing. Anyway, so he bowed down to all the starry hosts, worshipped them. And look at this. He built altars in the temple of God for all those starry hosts. Then he sacrificed his own son right there in the temple, by the way. He practiced sorcery, divination, consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the eye of God. Now, this fellow who had said the people did all kinds of evil things because there was no king, what would he have said had he lived 700 years later? Can you see how God's plan to use Israel as a showcase to draw people to him failed because the kings, the judges, and many of the prophets as well never lived up to God's expectation. Now, we may say human beings cannot, I agree, but God said, if you dwell in me and I dwell in you, it'll happen. So it never did happen. So the story ends with Israel finding itself exactly where it had been 1,000 years before, 1,200 years before, they were back into slavery, except it's a different country. Which country? Babylon. And now the rest of the story in just a few words. After 70 years, they go back to Israel. What was God's intent? Go back and rebuild the temple. What for? So that my temple shall be a house of prayer for the nations. Same intent, same plan. But what does Israel do? You know, they've learned their lesson. Idolatry equals slavery. So we don't want to be slaves anymore. We're going to protect ourselves against idolatry. And how's the best way to do that? That's what your song is about. We close our doors. We don't mingle with people because we're afraid that they will pollute us. So the church is repeating exactly the same thing. So they built walls around to the point that if they inadvertently touched a non-Jew, they'd rush to the next faucet, which was miles away because there was no running water. They did the running. And they had to wash to take away the pollution. And they built wall after wall after wall. And they even had a wall, and I've mentioned that many times here, around the temple with big letters in Hebrew and in Greek and in Latin that people could understand, which said, no non-Jew, Gentile, has the right to go beyond that wall. If they do and they are caught, they are going to be stoned. God had said, my temple should become a house for El. They built a wall around it and they excluded people. So God's plan failed because his ideal will was not understood or was not accepted by people who did their own will. Now, ultimately, God's plan doesn't fail, but it knows all kinds of delays. It knows all kinds of ups and downs like on a roller coaster because God respects. So when the second seed of Abraham came, which was Jesus, how many people in the nation were ready to welcome him? A handful, at least that's what the Bible talks about. And who were they? The spiritual leaders? Who were they? Shepherds. Now, I had a sermon here about the most despised people in Israel. Shepherds, women, children. Shepherds were despised. But somehow they still connected with God. But you know, shepherds don't have an impact because they're shepherds. They're despised by their own people. So God used wise men from the east who were not Jews, who were pagans, but who were closer to God than the Jews of the day. When I speak Jews, I'm not talking about today. I'm talking about history here. Okay, you've got to be careful. So God had to use pagans to tell to his nation, I'm come to live with you, to dwell in your midst. But they didn't understand. They didn't understand. They didn't want to understand. Do you know why? Because they had developed into this patriotic, this nationalistic entity that would not open up to admit anybody into the inside circle. And Jesus comes and says, I am come, not just for you, but for the Samaritan, for the Phoenicians, for the Greeks, for everyone. And suddenly their sense of patriotism is, and they don't want that. They don't want it. Now, you know, Jesus is a radical. And he says things that he knows is going to create problem. So what does he do? One day he says, tells a story amongst many stories. He says, there was a fellow who was wounded by the side of the road. Then who passes by? The president of the General Conference. But that fellow down there is a Catholic, the wounded one. The president has a look, and he sees a little cross there on his in the chain. He says, that's not an SDA. He has a cross around his neck, so I'll forget him. And he goes his way. Then who comes next? The secretary of the General Conference, scribes. They have a look at the guy. No. Then comes another group, another guy, all from the hierarchy. Now, these people, how were they considered by their own people? How did the nation consider the Pharisees and the scribes and those as being the elite spiritually? These are the spiritual leaders. God, Jesus doesn't say a Jew went by. He says the spiritual leaders went by and they never stopped. Then Jesus, you know, he hits hard. He says, and you know who stops? Who? Now, for you and for me, it doesn't mean a lot. But for them, it was the most insulting thing Jesus could say. Because the Samaritans and the Jews had been at each other's throat for 500 years. I won't get into the history of it. And there was such animosity between them that there was a prayer. Lord, I'm so grateful that you didn't create me a Samaritan. Now, that same prayer also says you didn't make a woman out of me. But anyway, we won't get into that one. We get problems with my wife. But that's what they prayed. But then there was another thing in Israel. There was a saying which went this way. If you see a sick Jew by the side of the road, just leave him there. You know, because the Jews believe that if you're sick, you've been punished by God. So if God's punished you, I can't come and help. But leave him there. But then it went on. If you see a sick Samaritan by the side of the road, grab a rock and crush his head. Now that's the kind of attitude against Samaritans. And Jesus says, you know guys, your president wasn't correct, your secretary wasn't correct, your theologians weren't correct, the one that God has approved of and appreciated is a Samaritan. So if you were a Jew back then, how would you feel? What would you want to do to Jesus? Embrace him or crucify him? You know, sometimes we say God wanted Jesus to be crucified. No, he didn't want. Human beings crucified Jesus. God recuperated it and turned it into a blessing. It's human beings, his own people, that crucified him. Because it was more, as the high priest said, it is more what? What's the word? Expedient. And when you talk expediency, it's all about personal interest, isn't it? National interest. So Israel failed miserably. And so Jesus said, as we conclude, what God has given you will be taken away from you and given to another group, which is the church. And maybe one day I'll have a series on the church to show that the church didn't do any better. First problem in the church was racism, the Jews and the Greeks. There you go. And that has still plagued the church to this day. It is. We hide it under all kinds of rationale, but it's still there. The church has not been the kind of showcase that God wants. The Roman church hasn't been, so God called the reformers. They haven't been, so he calls the evangelicals. They haven't been, so he calls the SDAs. And we aren't, so he'll call another church maybe someday. I hope not, but it can happen. We are so proud, we are arrogantly proud of our denominational history and the truth we hold on to, but our doors are still closed and we have no impact on the people out there, so we're failing God. Now I'm talking general here, I'm not talking individuals, there are lots of great people that are doing God's work. But I hope now that as you read the Bible with this kind of a background, you will understand some of the dynamics in the Bible. But also that you may think, I am part of this body called the church that God wants to use as a showcase for the world. God doesn't want us to preach. He wants us to show. And I have a text for that. There are hundreds of texts for that. Dozens. I'll give you one. Ephesians 3:9. So that as the universe looks down at the church, they can see God's wisdom made manifest in the relationship of the people in the church. Ephesians 3:9. Ephesians is about God bringing together Jews and Gentiles into one body. And this harmony is a sign of God's wisdom. Because human beings cannot do anything to bring people together. Even in the most sacred of union, which is marriage, it fails 3 times out of 5. Only God can do that. So today, was lots of history, lots of background for you to understand the Bible better when you read it. But the lesson is, are you individually and corporately a showcase for God? You know, God doesn't care too much whether you have the right doctrines. What God cares about is, do you reflect His character? That's what God cares about. Now, correct doctrines is important. I'm not denying that. But the Jews had the correct doctrine. They were rejected. And I've said to you many times, tongue in cheek, who's the one that knows everything about doctrines? Who is he? Satan. He says Satan knows it all. And he trembles. Why does he tremble? He has the right doctrine. Because he doesn't live up to what he knows.